Welcome to Manufacturing Talk Radio, the only show that takes a look at the obstacles and opportunities open to small to mid-sized enterprises that manufacture here in America. Brought to you by All Metals and Forge Group, with your hosts, Tim Grady and Lou Wise.
Welcome, everyone, to Manufacturing Talk Radio. My name is Tim Grady. I'm here with my co-host, Lou Wise. Lou, how are you today?
I'm great, and I'm almost recovered from the FabTech show out in Chicago that you and I did for 4 days. My feet are great, and I'm all rested out. So on with the show.
That was a challenging show. Long show. We learned a lot while we were there. So I really enjoyed it.
50,000 attendants, 1,500 exhibitors, and 750,000 square feet. It was quite a show.
We couldn't interview them all.
We tried.
But on today's show, we have Norbert Orr back with us. Norbert is one of our senior correspondents. He's also the director and head of industry surveys for Strategus Research Partners. He's also the former chair of the Institute of Supply Management's Manufacturing Business Survey Committee that put out the report on business every month. Norbert, how are you today?
Great. Happy to be with you.
Well, we're certainly excited to have you here. You're putting out a document that you put out very close to the first of every month, which is a global business survey insights. And so I'd like you to share with us what that report is showing for manufacturing going forward. Everybody's kind of on pins and needles. How are we doing? Where are we going? Are we going to hold up?
Yeah, every month offers a new challenge, I guess, in terms of interpreting what's going on. We seem to be on a very flat spell as far as manufacturing is concerned. The ISM data came in. August was 51.1, September 50.2, October 50.1. So not much growing in the manufacturing sector. The good news is we've seen some of the activity in Europe and Asia and the UK all improved last month. And so I think maybe we hit an inflection point as far as manufacturing is concerned, and I would be encouraged to see it come back a little bit in November and December.
Norbert, in view of the fact that this is 2 days after the French terrorist attack, do you feel as though that there's going to be any significant interruption in the numbers for the next 2, 3 months, 4 months?
I don't think it'll have that much of a global effect, but it's certainly going to be an impact. France has been in a manufacturing recession for months. And the last 2 months, September and October, their index was at 50.6 in each month. August was 48.3. And so I think it's probably going to have more of an impact. The malaise that comes with it, the uncertainty that comes with it, the expectations that kind of fall between the cracks as far as their economy is concerned. So I think it'll have a much greater impact. You know, it's got to hurt tourism in France, and certainly on an economy that was marginal to begin with, this additional challenge is going to be a tough scene for quite a number of months.
There's no question about that.
So how is the Eurozone in general doing, Norbert?
Well, as I mentioned, the overall, some of our trading partners had a much better month. Now, that's unusual. And I think we also have to factor in the services sector in the United States is the fastest growing area economic index is fastest growing of any that we monitor globally. That index was at 59.1. So we have this divergence between the U.S. manufacturing and U.S. services, The good news is services are about four times larger than manufacturing, so that can carry the U.S. economy. Back to the Eurozone. Overall, their index was at 52.3. That was up 0.3 of a point. Greece was the only country in the Eurozone of the eight countries that was not showing growth. And even Greece is, they should take delight in the fact that they're not declining as fast as the index came in at 47.3, which given their situation, I guess that's a real plus, is to not be in as rapid a descent as they have been. But, you know, Italy was at 54.1, Netherlands at 53.7, and Ireland at 53.6. So some real strength there. And then the real surprise this past month was the UK. Their index was up 3.7 points to 55.5. And that, this is the 31st consecutive month that they've been above 50. So the UK has gone through this quite well. If anybody... I think it feels some problems from everything that's gone on in Paris. It probably would be the UK because they identify with many of the situations that France has in terms of immigration, et cetera. So, and the proximity, they're very strong trading partners. So they could be impacted if anybody is going to.
Norbert, I, from a selfish, self-centered position, from the fact that I sell steel forgings, I'm looking at Chicago, which is you know, the center of industry in this country, and it has a 56.2 PMI. And the U.S. is 50.1, I believe. What's going on in Chicago in that whole Midwest Rust Belt area?
Obviously, Chicago is kind of a paradox. The way the index is structured in Chicago, it's 65% manufacturing and 35% non-manufacturing.
Mm.
And it's one of the reasons I hesitate to put a lot of credence in what's coming from Chicago because of that issue. And they were up almost 8 points. That's the other reason, is that's a lot of variability. And so it makes me worry about that. But if the services sector is as strong as the national services sector, it's probably more a reflection of what's going on. And you probably know this better than I, Lou. A lot of people point to Chicago and say, well, that's a good indication of the auto industry. I think it's an indicator, whether it's a good indicator of autos. Again, it's hard to break out. I like they've restarted the Southeastern Michigan survey, and it came in at 58.4. Now, Southeastern Michigan also uses the services, the 65-35. The only difference is there's really not much of a service sector in Detroit, and so it's mostly the manufacturing sector, I think, that is really reporting from that. Then on the other side of Chicago, I like Milwaukee, so I pay more attention to Milwaukee and Detroit than I do the Chicago survey, frankly.
Well, I would think that the tourist rate of Detroit is not really high on the parade of these numbers.
But I think that'd be a safe bet.
Meanwhile, the auto sales are projected this year at 17.9, I think, 8 million. That's pretty close to, I think the highest is 22 million, but it's a pretty high number, 18 million units.
Yeah, it's obvious, you know, the auto industry benefited from the fact that a lot of people, after Lehman Brothers, debacle and so on, a lot of people had car credit that didn't have credit to buy houses, or they weren't willing to take the risk of buying the house, but they could get the credit and invest in automobiles. I think, frankly, I'm, you know, like everybody else, somewhat of an observer of the auto industry. They've got the best lineup of products that they've ever had. They really have products that people want. And so I think it's really encouraged that. And the recovery in, you know, in housing has been very slow. And it's, there were those who expected this year to take off, and I didn't feel that could happen because it's such a long cycle of, involved in home building in terms of permitting, building permits and so on, land acquisition, et cetera, et cetera. So many are looking for a better year in 2016 from that, but, right now, between the services sector and autos, that's where the heart of the recovery is in the U.S., and I don't think we can afford for either one of those to back off. We would have some real problems with the dollar as strong as it is. That would be a real challenge for us.
Well, Norbert, how are the economies doing north and south of our U.S. borders in Canada and Mexico?
Doing those two are diverging also. Canada came in with a fairly weak month, and they are too looking at a manufacturing recession at least, and probably an overall recession. Their index has averaged 49.6 since January for manufacturing. So the Canadian economy is commodity based, and that's where their big bucks come from. Of course, we didn't help them at all with the Keystone Pipeline going. We're not going to support the idea of that.
Right.
That was one of the ways, one of the best ways for them to move product out of Canada. So they've still got a struggle in front of them. Now there's a new government, so there's a great deal of uncertainty. Not a pretty picture. Mexico, on the other hand, saw production expanding at its fastest rate since May. They've been on a roll for quite a number of months. A lot of that is auto industry. They benefit greatly. We make a lot of products for the auto industry that either are built or assembled in Mexico, and what is built isn't built in Mexico gets built here with components coming out of Mexico.
We did a report five, 6 months ago on the aerospace segment of Mexico, where they're getting an incredible amount of movement from companies leaving Texas and California and opening up down in Mexico. There's about 400 companies now making U.S. aircraft parts, which kind of concerns me.
Well, you know, the good news is the aircraft industry, and when we talk about autos and services, we ought to probably also add aircraft in because that's doing quite well. And there's so many different companies, and not only the big people like Boeing, but the Gulfstreams and so on. Also, you have Airbus. With a new facility in Mobile, Alabama, and so the aviation industry is quite good right now. We don't keep all of it here, but a lot of what they buy is low volume comparatively. They're not putting out 500,000 787s a month. It's very low numbers. And so it's a lot of custom product and so on that is going to find its way to those who have comparative advantage. And labor is, in this case, comparative advantage.
Norbert, I know that each month you follow the PMI number, and you also do a survey yourself, and that's for Strategus Research Partners, and if anybody wants to be part of that Strategus Research Partners survey, they need to send an email to nore at Strategas RP. It's STRATEGASRP.com. And let Norbert Orr know that you would like to participate in that survey because you're a manufacturer. As you looked at...
Yeah, let me also add to that, Tim. One, I appreciate you adding that in. But the benefit of doing it is there's only two questions: what's happening to new orders and what's happening to supplier deliveries. And the benefit to anybody that participates is you get this information back when it's published. And you also get my review of the monthly global PMI situation and global business situation along with that. So as a reward for participating, you get a lot of good information, plus the fact that Strategas does an awful lot of research work that has application to people in supply chains, and it's a real opportunity to get online to see some of that work. I share that when something applies to supply chains that I think is interesting, I send it out to the people that are on the panel. So there is reciprocity. Give me your data on a monthly basis, and I'll shoot you a lot of information back.
Robert, as you know, we have a monthly newsletter. We'll put a spot in there about that for the sake of our readers. About joining Strategas survey.
Very good.
And what, if you can share it with us, Norbert, what does November look like for manufacturers? Is it improving? Is it still soft? Where is it headed?
I expect that we'll see a slight improvement. All of this ties back to what's happening with GDP. And, are we seeing any growth in the economy, and particularly on the manufacturing side? And manufacturing is pretty much going sideways, but I think we'll see a little bit of an upward movement this month. I'll be surprised. One, we can't go any lower and still be growing than where we were. And the other thing is I've found that the November data you'll recall the index went from 52 in September from 50.2 in September to 50.1 in October, which in essence means it's a little bit weaker. But the reality was the both new orders and production were above 52. And so by my way of judging it, October was a much better month than September, even though the index was slightly lower. So I think that was an inflection point where we'll continue to see some growth in the manufacturing sector. It's just not going to be certainly nobody's going to call it remarkable by the end of the year.
We might.
Well, we have a wheel in the office, in the studio here, that has numbers on it from 0 to 4.0 in one-tenth increments, which we spin to figure out what the GDP number is going to be for the fourth quarter. What do you think it's going to be, Norbert?
Well, obviously, there's a number of economists that are subscribing to your service and one in on the spin. I think we're going to be back down under 2%, and frankly, that should be totally unacceptable to us. We have lagged significantly in this recovery from where we have been, and we're going to continue to get the same result unless we make some major changes in public policy that allows both manufacturing and non-manufacturing to grow faster than what we're seeing currently. GDP is a measurement of the overall economy that is very, very loose comparatively. And by loose, what I mean is they do a lot of survey work and so on to try to get that right, but they come back with their revisions and so on. So you never know on the first read just exactly where you're going to be. when they end up.
Yeah, it takes the second or third revision to know that they're probably wrong anyway.
Yeah, Lou, if you know, we really ought to have the discipline to say, I'm not going to pay any attention to that number until it gets to the second revision.
That's exactly right.
The revisions always seem to go, and you know, employment looked real good. That's generally a good indicator of strength in the economy, but a lot of it was temporary jobs. So maybe it didn't look quite as good as the total number was, and the number that they the headline number that they use. I was looking today at the New York or Empire State Survey, and they don't do a PMI, but I make up a PMI based on the data that they've got, which makes it comparable so that when I talk about it, it's equivalent to the others. PMI for the Empire State was 44.3. So a very weak report. Now, that's their October data. That's not November. But certainly that area of the country is not doing as well as others. Philadelphia was weak. Dallas was weak. So there's geographically, there's hot spots and cold spots around the country of areas that are doing well. We talked about aviation. The Pacific Northwest has weakened a little bit, but still holding its own, I guess. But anyway, there's various areas that are strong and various areas that are weak.
So should we move to Chicago?
If you want to, for this month anyway, and you might be able to get in and out of there in November before weather gets too bad.
Right.
Norbert, how does South America look? I know Brazil is weak, but other than Brazil, is there any bright shining star in South America?
Well, I just got back from Jamaica this week and was down there for a couple of days. And the Caribbean in general is soft. Jamaica, Trinidad, all could use some more growth, but they're so highly dependent on what comes out of the U.S. In terms of supply, demand, and so on, to be able to do that. The rest of South America is still more in a recession than anything else. Brazil's obviously the biggest economy in South America, and Brazil has they have two things going on right now. One of them is getting ready for the Olympics, and it looks like to me, what reading I've been able to do on it, they're struggling. They were supposed to build a number of different sites and so on, and they're way behind on the schedule of that. So we'll see how they handle that. And on the other side of the equation, the petroleum industry and chemical industry, which is where they've made a lot of bets as far as the future, those are very soft, and so South America is struggling in general.
So I guess our next jump is across the Western pond to Asia. How does Asia look?
Yeah, Asia looks better. The Japanese survey came in at 52.4. Japan seems to be moving in the right direction. India has weakened just a little bit, but yet holding up and should continue to do okay. And again, we're talking manufacturing in these countries, mm-hmm. obviously. The two China surveys, one survey, the CFLP, the official survey, came in at 49.8, but it's averaged, I think, 49.9 for all of this year. The other survey is called the Caixin China General Manufacturing Survey, And it seems to be a little more reflective. They include multinationals, and so we're going to see a little more variability there, which is good because it shows some things moving in the right direction when and if they do. The best information we have, and I'll rely on my associates at Strategus, the best information we have, we believe that they are running somewhere around 5 to 7% growth. The problem is they've tried to convert to a consumer-based economy from a goods and from a capital goods-based or a investment-based economy with spending on infrastructure and so on. In order to get the economy going again, we believe that they're going to have to start to focus on more infrastructure and the things they were trying to move away from, that they can mobilize that better than they can mobilize the consumer economy that they're trying to put in place. And so seeing that happen, the other thing that I always remember is China has a middle class between 200 and 300 million people. And I think that's a very upwardly mobile middle class. They're educated. They want more. So I think they'll do that. But I do think if they shift back toward the infrastructure-based economy, they could come out of this much quicker. And frankly, that would help commodities and so on. It would have more of a lift more of a lift outside of China because of that. So hopefully, hopefully they'll be able to get that reignited.
Okay. Well, that certainly sounds much stronger. I see mining still continues to struggle in the U.S. Is that also true around the world, Norbert?
Yeah, it's whether it's like I said, I was in Jamaica, and that's the site of a lot of bauxite mining, and that's slow, obviously, with aluminum doing what it's doing. Copper is at lows that are ridiculously cheap in terms of copper, but China consumes 40% of the world's copper production. So if they're not building, that industry is going to struggle. And most of the others, titanium, et cetera, most of them, even with aircraft and with the autos putting aluminum bodies in and so on, there's still a huge amount of excess capacity that's slowly getting shut in. So the market will correct over time.
Well, that's good to know. We appreciate the update report. We're going to take a commercial break, and we've been speaking with Norbert Orr, who is the Director and Head of Industry Surveys for Strategus Research Partners, and he always shares a lot of information on the 18 global surveys that he follows. Norbert, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure as always.
Thank you, Norbert.
And we'll be back after this brief commercial break.
Manufacturing Talk Radio will be right back.
American Crane and Equipment Corporation in Douglasville, Pennsylvania is a leader in specialized cranes, hoists, and material handling equipment for industries including aerospace, nuclear, oil and gas, transit, construction, and waste handling. Call 877-877-6778 or visit AmericanCrane.com. That's AmericanCrane.com or 877-877-6778.
How do you keep your business humming? Where do you go when you're looking for quality suppliers of new equipment? Components, MRO supplies, repair services, or even raw materials? 30 years ago, you would have turned to the Thomas Register. Today, those big green books are better than ever at thomasnet.com, industry's leading platform for product sourcing and supplier discovery. You can easily find that local machine shop, national distributor, OEM, or any supplier having the right quality certification, fast and free. You can even get to specific products, components, or downloadable 3D CAD drawings simply by entering specifications or part numbers. There's a reason ThomasNet.com has become the go-to supplier discovery tool for procurement professionals and engineers. There's simply no other resource like it, and it's all free. Go to ThomasNet.com today and see how top-notch supplier discovery doesn't have to put a dent into your bottom line.
All Metals and Forge Group is an ISO 9001 AS and EN 9100 manufacturer of open die forgings and seamless rolled rings in alloy, carbon, stainless and tool steels, aluminum, copper, titanium, and nickel alloys. Visit us at steelforge.com or call 800-600-9290.
Welcome back to Manufacturing Talk Radio.
And you're listening to Manufacturing Talk Radio with your host, Tim Grady and Lou Wise. And we are talking in this segment with Stephen Gold, who's president and CEO of the Manufacturers Alliance for Productivity and Innovation, commonly known as MAPI. It's a membership organization that provides unique thought leadership for the manufacturing sector through economic research and executive development opportunities for manufacturing executives. Put out a lot of terrific information. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good promo for MAPI. Thank you.
You're welcome. We allow people to shamelessly promote their organization on our show.
Well, you can keep it up. And I've noticed you guys have had some really smart people on, and you, I guess my colleague Jen Calloway was on not that long ago. I'm not sure how you ended up with me on, but I'm delighted to be here.
Well, you put together a terrific report, you know, the five megatrends in manufacturing, which we're looking forward to speaking with you about today. Can you share with us, Stephen, with our listeners, how you developed that report and what those five megatrends are?
Sure, and let me just take a step back and note that, you know, megatrends are not new to manufacturing. I always say manufacturer. So it's not new for manufacturing. But we are living in a new era. Go back, but all time. And so what we did was we went out to we went out to our members and we went out to our experts. We have a number of experts on staff, and we talked about what are the seismic shifts that are occurring now or will be occurring over the next couple of decades that are going to have an impact and can't really transform that manufacturing. And I will say this, I left a number of them out. I mean, there's in fact disagreement. I'm not sure if we've sent you our megatrend brochure, but they, people who put the megatrend brochure together, included a topic I didn't include, regulation, and I included the topic they. So the five megatrends to initially publicize, and believe me, again, there are plenty of others, and they're very broad. One is technology's promise and perils, and I'll just go through the list, and then we can talk about them. But one is what we call the new workforce. One is information as the new currency, and what we mean by that really is data. And of course, there's some overlap with these, as you can imagine, these topics. One is globalized risks and opportunities, and that really gets to the crux of the global marketplace, the new risks and opportunities that manufacturers are seeing in a global marketplace. And the final one, which is a longer-term trend but should have a big impact on manufacturers, is urbanization.
Well, why don't you start from the top, and let's talk about the new industrial revolution.
I will, and that's great. It's a perfect place to start because everybody knows it's happening. Gordon Moore back in 1965 predicted that the number of transistors in an integrated circuit would double approximately every 2 years. He did not know that it would last half a century. And what we're seeing is the first industrial revolution, of course, was mechanization generated by steam power. The second was mass production generated by electricity. electric power. What we're seeing now is really a combination of connectivity and digitalization that is creating really an exponential growth in technology. Just to give you some examples, the smartphones of today, and you know, those of us who didn't have them back when, compared to their, you know, the bulky mobile phones that we had in the late 1980s, the computing power of today's smartphone is it's a million times cheaper, it's a million times smaller, it's 1,000 times more powerful. The world population today is 7.3 billion. The number of connected devices in the world is 11 billion. So what you're seeing is this exponential growth in technology, and that's having a huge impact on manufacturing, because obviously it's leading to smarter factories, what we call, what we're, you're starting to, you've heard over the last few years, the industrial internet, where you have, you know, factory floors that and integrated supply chains that are using physical components, that are using software and smart components, and that are using connectivity. And that's improving productivity, it's improving time to market, it's improving, reducing the number of errors and such. So, and then, of course, that's for manufacturers. What's the next step is what we call the Internet of Things, which is going to connect everything. We're connecting, you know, your refrigerator in 10 years will be able to tell your grocery store that you're out of milk. And, of course, we already know that houses, you know, thermostats are able to talk to utilities, and we're able to control our climate control our houses through that. So again, this is leading to enormous change in the manufacturing sector. I haven't even mentioned 3D printing, which is, you know, mass customization. I mean, mass production combined with customization has never happened before. You know, nanotechnology. Which is making products, you know, smaller but safer and more durable, but there's a downside. So those are the promises. There's an enormous manufacturing is going to it's going to be worth hundreds of billions of dollars to manufacturers. But the downside, of course, is that hackers can get your not only site, they can go ahead and you know, steal your intellectual property. So that's the technology's promise and perils that we're seeing.
Okay. You know, one of the things that comes up in many of our shows is the aging workforce. And right on the tail of that is automation and robotics. Stephen, where is that going?
Yeah, so that's, of course, the new workforce is the second mega trend. And I'll touch on the robotics in a second. But let me just note, 10,000 baby boomers are retiring every day here. That's, you know, manufacturing is... Not just manufacturing, every sector is seeing a rapidly aging workforce. The good news is that the United States is not aging as fast as the other, and it's good news for us, but not aging, its workforce is not aging as fast as other developed nations and actually developing nations for that matter. The world is growing very fast. By 2050, the median age in Germany, Japan, and South Korea is going to be over 50. In China, it'll be 46, but in the United States, it'll be 41. So that's needless to say, there's a challenge there because we're losing a large institutional body of knowledge as well as a large number of people from a workforce. Now, the upside to that, of course, is that automation increases productivity. And you're seeing that in the rise of robotics, where you're seeing you know, companies using robots and humans together to create, you know, safer, you know, faster production times and such. And so there's an interesting debate going on, of course, of whether robots will take over, you know, the world. You see economists on two sides of the aisle. David Artur is out of MIT, though, is a strong believer that this is actually going to be end up raising our living standards and the introduction of robotics and more automation, because we have an aging workforce and because we won't be able to somehow we have to increase productivity if we're going to increase our living standards. So that's something that we're seeing much, much faster at a faster rate today than we even expected just 10 years ago. Let me note one other thing about demographics. It's not just about aging. We also, you know, our population's changing. The white working age population in this country in 1980 was 82% of the population was white working, was white. It's by 2020, it's going to be 63%. Our demographics in terms of the number of women and minorities coming into the workforce is also, is, aside from the aging, that's another huge demographic change in our society. But that's actually because we have more, and this is, you know, somewhat politically controversial, but because we have a more open immigration policy here, it's going to allow us at least to grow our workforce to some extent, unlike, you know, countries like China or Japan or Germany.
This is Lou, Stephen. The other factors that will help our workforce is bringing women into the focus more than past decades. Women in manufacturing is a great resource, and they're really gaining a lot of importance coast to coast. And additionally, there's the veteran issue. And there are organizations out there that are training and retraining valor heroes to get them jobs. And we're talking about millions of people, both included
yes.
with women and veterans.
Yeah, yeah, very good points. And of course, in terms of the veterans trained in technical skills, this is one of the challenges. Of course, you guys know, you've had guests on before talk about the millennials may be digital natives, but they are, as we know, in our society, more and more lacking in the science, technology, engineering, math skills. And these veterans coming out are trained in that, and so that is something that you're seeing more and more groups helping. And manufacturers are working with veterans groups, are working with, you know, technical colleges and such to try to do that. And again, you're a good point about the women as well. The challenge we have is that it's kind of manufacturing, as you guys know, is stigmatized for so long that a survey, I think. An NAM survey showed, 37% of U.S. adults would encourage their children to enter manufacturing, which is a huge mistake because that is the future of our middle class, and of course, a large number of youth would find very fulfilling careers in manufacturing.
Steven, consistent with Moore's law and the doubling of transistors every 18 to 24 months, the cost of robotics seems to be plummeting at a fairly rapid rate, and the ROI seems to be shortening. What's happening in robotics and manufacturing?
Yeah, so it's interesting, and you're seeing it's, and it's tied to what's happening in robotics. Is it's tied to the entire increase in automation in manufacturing. In Europe, of course, they call it Industry 4.0. Here we call it the Industrial Internet. But you are robotics are taking over an increasing number of roles in which they can work with humans. They're obviously robotic math skills are better. They can make faster decisions, but they don't have judgment. They don't have common sense. And so what you're seeing is a number of companies, especially in our membership, combining the use of robotics in not only in the making of, obviously, automotive and aerospace, but in along smaller, more discrete factory floors. And I think that's tied to the third megatrend, which is the information as currency, because what you're able to do is big data in has been in retail and finance for a long time, and what they do with big data in those is they try to determine what customer buying are. But in manufacturing, it's more than just that. It's about trying to come up with a total customer experience, and data allows manufacturing to accelerate the integration of IT, of manufacturing, and of operational systems on the shop floor, includes robotics. Leads to better forecasting, leads to better plant performance, but it also is going to, you know, customers now know more about the total cost of ownership. And manufacturers becoming service-oriented. The big information on hand allows us not to be reactive, but to be proactive in terms of how our manufacturers take large products. And we're not necessarily talking toaster ovens or something. You know, we're talking about major engines and such that go into airplanes and such. It allows, you know, our manufacturers to respond to, you know, the challenge, the downtime, to see to put sensors in these products and collect data to determine how fast they're wearing out and such. So for manufacturing, big data is actually about both trying to help the customer more, create it's a new form of competition, but also improving the productivity on the factory floor.
Now, you've also talked, Stephen, about global supply chains in the marketplace. That's a huge shift for manufacturing. You know, you're used to get your supplies, if you were in Wisconsin, from Iowa, and your competitor was in Illinois. That's no longer the case, is it?
No, and although we're seeing a number of trends change over, you know, so 20 years ago, or even at the turn of the century, the millennia, you know, you saw longer and longer supply chains being created, obviously with low cost, relatively inexpensive labor in Asia and then Latin America and such. You could stretch the supply chains out. The fourth megatrend is what we call global risks and opportunities. And supply chains, while supply chain, it sometimes it makes a lot of sense to stretch them halfway across the world, as we now know. There are a number of factors that can impede the success of the supply chain. All you have to do is what happened with the tsunami in Japan a few years back. And by the way, there are other, you know, I did not put nearshoring as a megatrend, but you are seeing a shift in supply chains because if you have political instability or economic instability in certain areas, you know, manufacturers are revisiting how to optimize their supply. But the fact is, you know, it's a global marketplace, you know, you have rapidly growing, relative to developed nations, rapidly growing markets in South America. And still in China and India, although obviously right now it's your previous guests talked about it. You know, things are slowing down around the world a bit, but because you have these rapidly growing marketplaces, American manufacturers are, you know, they're 95% of our customers are outside of our borders, and because of that, 45% of the U.S. manufacturing revenue is generated now overseas. You know, they want to be close to their markets. So to that extent, supply chains, if it's easier to make components in one part of the world and bring them over to another, and now manufacturers know that, you know, if they can reduce the or mitigate the risk, they'll do that. But if they can get closer to the marketplace, they'll do that as well. But the global marketplace, there are all sorts of risks. Currency fluctuations obviously have become a huge risk for manufacturers as well. So there are a number of the mega trend there is simply that it's a global marketplace, and we are realizing now that there are enormous opportunities, but there are also some sizable risks when companies go global.
And I think the last mega trend, which I find fascinating, and I really want to ask you if it's a U.S. phenomenon that we're going to see in addition to a global, or is it more global and not so U.S., and that's the growth of new mega cities.
Yeah, urbanization is a fascinating, and I'll tell you why it's important to manufacturing. It's a fascinating phenomenon. And the U.N., is estimating that the number of people, percentage of people living in urban areas is going to climb from 54% today to 66% by the year 2050. That's a migration of 2.4 billion people. Now, you are going to see some of it in this country, but most of it's actually going to occur in Asia and in Africa. And you're in fact, I think the number of megacities today is 29. This is if you have 10 million or more people, it's going to be 41 by the year 2030. Now, the reason this is important for manufacturing is, first of all, it does create great opportunities in terms of a diversity of production-related resources. It creates global geographic clusters where you can combine, you know, human labor with educational institutions, with suppliers, with manufacturers. But most important is that this is an indication of the rise of the middle class. And we have 1.8 billion middle class in the world. Well, we had in 2009 about 1.8 billion people in the middle class. In 2020, that's going to be 3.2 billion people. And in 2030, it's going to be 4.9 billion people. Now, a rise of the middle class is the key to manufacturing success. When people have money, they buy products. Now, most of our members typically are B2B, or industrial members, but the fact of the matter is the end customer is always going to be the consumer. And that number of middle class consumers around the world is an enormous opportunity for U.S. manufacturers, because our products are still the most highly valued around the world. So that's it's fascinating that that's going to be happening. Remember, it's not going to be, you won't really see it. I mean, you have New York City, you have L.A., but in this country you have a limited number. And most of those megacities are going to be in Asia and in Africa.
We're hearing good news coming. We're hearing other good news coming out of Africa in terms of manufacturing beginning to take hold at low cost and some higher education levels. What's your take on that?
Well, I'll be honest. We do track all the regions of the world. Africa is behind. It is the of all the continents, it's the one that's slowest to develop. You have some of the more affluent countries in Africa that U.S. and Chinese and European countries are starting to invest in. But there is the huge challenge of Africa still, and this is infrastructure and education. And so it's behind Eastern Europe in this area. It's and Latin America for that matter. It's really the developing world in which our members are, and our U.S. manufacturers are just beginning to go over and try to determine. But because of the previous megatrend that I just mentioned, it's something that they're looking at with a long-term, at least U.S. manufacturers, with a long-term lens. There's something that they can, you know, by the year 2030, assuming political stability in Africa, and again, you have several Africas, right? You have the North Africa, which is not a politically stable area right now. You have Central and South Southern Africa. Assuming political stability in a growing number of countries and an increased infrastructure, which is really critical, they need Western help for that. Then you're going to definitely see manufacturing occur there. Again, they're a long way away, though, from in terms of, especially at the educational level, in terms of developing universities and school systems that can really, considering manufacturing in the next 15 years is going to be almost completely advanced, even what we consider labor-intensive manufacturing is going to be advanced within the next 15 years.
Stephen,
and so you'll need those skills. Go on. Sorry.
You were talking a few moments ago about stability and political stability. This week we've had we've been shaken to our boots with what's gone on in France and Belgium, and you know, we know that economists predict based on known factors today, and then something happens overnight, and then the factors change. And as Dr. Chris Keel would say from FAM, would say this, this, and this, unless this happens. or this, this, and this, unless that happens. So the things that we've been talking about, is anything factored in regards to the possibilities of continued terrorism that's even going now beyond the borders of the Mideast?
Well,
just to comment one more point. I remember 9/11 when that happened here in the New York area. My primary business is producing open die forgings. We were receiving order cancellations the next day, and it took years to come out of that gray funk. So, in one day, the entire environment changed. And not
you're
to
exactly
say
that, right. And in fact, I was going to mention that. That's exactly right. Now, we actually there is evidence that now remember the 2001 recession was a very mild recession, except for manufacturing. Manufacturing entered a pretty significant recession because of 9/11, and a good amount of evidence that 9/11 led to that because of a halt in global trade. And there is a concern that this kind of incident. Now we haven't seen it yet. The market, of course, has rebounded, but there is a concern that if you see these kinds of incidents, mass incidents occurring, that it could create some kind of slowdown in trade until manufacturers and others can come to grips with what type of corporate security and other kinds of security measures they're going to need. But this particular incident that occurred is going to have a more of a direct impact on the, you know, let's face it, the travel and hospitality industry. But there's no doubt that little hiccups, and this was not little, obviously, but it is in terms of the global economy, but little hiccups do have a huge ripple effects on an economy. And we've been going through a number of them anyway, port closures and, you know, oil issues with Iran and the Chinese financial crisis and such. So all these, they all add up, it could very well that this kind of is the straw that breaks the camel's back, and we might, I don't think my economist would say this right now, but you might see us have another slowdown for manufacturing in this country, maybe a quarter in which we contract.
Well, there's another point, and it's really a kind of a gross point to bring up. But when 9/11 happened, that was the first one. Not only did the United States go into total panic, but so did other nations around the world. Well, here it is 15 years later, and we've had this event and that event, and we've had France a couple of times. We had Belgium arrests. I'm just wondering if we're just beginning to get used to it, that this is the new norm and we're going to have these events happening, and it may or may not affect manufacturing, and people may or may not be affected as much as they were 15 years ago. You're right about it affecting travel and entertainment and tourism and so on, but yet the second night after the event in France, the restaurants were all filled down by the Champs-Élysées. So maybe we're just getting used to it.
Well, and of course, you know, let's face it, the Israelis have been living in this kind of under these conditions for many years, and maybe we are getting used to it. On the other hand, it's those of us with children and grandchildren, it's something that obviously we hope we can get a grasp on and mitigate in the coming years. But I'll say this though, you're quite right. I think it is something. The first 9/11 was new, and now it's not. You know, now it's not necessarily new anymore. That's exactly right.
Yeah, we have been talking with Stephen Gold, who's president and CEO of the Manufacturers Alliance for Productivity and Innovation. Stephen, we appreciate you being on the show today. It went way too fast for us. We're going to have you back on. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
And tune in next week to catch Manufacturing Talk Radio. That concludes our broadcast for today.
Thanks for joining us on Manufacturing Talk Radio. You can hear our next broadcast each Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time at mfgtalkradio.com.